I had a strong feeling that I knew so little about Cork. I have never been in Cork before, I'm ashamed to say. And then I was thinking this afternoon, actually, I looked at what time this started and I lay down to sleep. And instead of sleeping, suddenly all the people of Cork that I knew came to me. My dad taught engineering maths at Queen's University in Belfast, and he taught alongside a brilliant mathematician called Paddy Donohoe, who was from Cork City. And Paddy died fairly young. But the librarian from the university came to my dad and said, it's a bit delicate, I don't want to approach the family, but maybe you could check, you know, Paddy's office. And Paddy had 279 overdue library books on his shelves. And Paddy was married to Pat Donohoe, also from Cork, and her brother, I started to doubt my memory of these anecdotes, but her brother was a tailor and worked for the same firm as had made the suit for Michael Collins. And so when they were making The Wind That Shakes the Barley, they located Pat's brother. Obviously it wasn't he himself, but they got the same tailoring firm to make the costumes for the film. And Pat's brother was really chuffed. They honoured him, the film crew took him to Cannes with them, and he got slightly drunk when he got back and fell off his bicycle. She was furious with him. He was in his 80s. It was Theo Dorgan has been a friend for a long, long time, and we still repeat his Cork joke, and it's dire out of a Cork accent, but he told us it a long time ago. "Come quickly, come quickly. My son, Kieran, the engineer, is drowning." And last year at the Galway International Arts Festival, he gave a marvellous interview just about himself. It was a very reluctant interview. He doesn't like talking about his own background, but it was amazing about him, his father and his mother and the Cork he was born into. I have a friend whose grandfather worked, did you have a Rolls Royce factory here?
No.
Ford.
He worked for the Ford factory as an engineer for a year. No, it was definitely Cork he was in. But he left because he didn't like the way the workers were treated. And Bob Welsh, who was the professor of English at the University of Coleraine, or the new University of Ulster, and his wife Angela. And I remember Bob telling us how when he was a young idealistic student, he'd done some translations of the Irish poet Sean O'Riordan, and he took them out to Sean O'Riordan's house and could see him through the window, but Sean O'Riordan didn't open the door, wouldn't open the door. I think he did, in the end, accept or give us a blessing to the translations, but this is my patchwork knowledge of Cork. And then Joan Newman, my mum, who's a writer since the 60s, and would have been here tonight, but she couldn't make it, had something called a subdural hematoma in September, which is a bleed on her brain, not in it, thankfully. But she lost speech for a while, which is doubly terrifying for a writer. But she was in the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast and encountered an amazing young doctor who was both meticulous and humane, and she's called Megan Carey. So if you encounter Dr. Megan Carey, she's worth knowing. And I think she's come back home to doctor, so you might, who knows when you might meet her. And most recently, the reason I'm here, in a sense, is because my friend George Angel, from Medellin, Colombia, he was my translator when I was privileged to be a guest there. He came and read to you about 6 weeks ago and loved it. Absolutely was smitten by Cork and ye all. The other connection then that I was trying to think of things that would make this relevant, and of course the Titanic, which sailed, Belfast sort of claims it, but it came to Cove, mm-hmm. as you all know. So this is a poem about the Titanic. You mentioned collaboration with Bill Campbell, the guitarist, has an amazing piece of music. That's on that CD. If you want to hear music, the music of sound drowning, he's written it. Until the next time, all my love. Recklessness and the lethal, uncommunicating ice ripped through the steep, audacious metal dream. And the 507 victualling crew were fed to the sea. With the 438 gallons of ice cream and the 190 bundles of cheese and the 2,500 pounds of sausages. Salt water mixed with the fresh water brought for the first class passengers' showers and drenched into the pile of Axminsters and Wiltons, the tapestries, the 8,000 cigars, the 11 cases of orchids, the 40,000 eggs, oh, shell break and yolk float. Seawater made a monstrous dough of the 250 barrels of flour, a macabre laundry of the 45,000 napkins and 18,000 bedsheets. Six Steinways thumping tantrums, sodden sonatas, a music flooding with furthers and unders, plain and smoked sardines, potted shrimps, Norwegian anchovies, soused herrings returned to the deep, and sacks and sacks and sacks of letters. Until the next time, all my love, I hope to hear from you soon, dear, dearest sir, darling, dearest. As language sealed the ocean's envelope around its soluble sentiments. Morse code and Marconi's code fought over the alphabet. CQD, SOS. CQD, flash lamps, unanswered beams, tilting to heaven and hell, underwater bells signalling thumps and grumbles in its own demented dialect. They think now it was steel itself, the stupid speed, the sharp ice, sharp speed, stupid ice. The misreading of it all caused the rip, but the fracture, the crack, the fissure ran and ran and sundered, because steel itself then was not strong enough to keep the faith. How do we make of our lives a vessel wild enough to hold the dancing and the decadence? What can we use to stay afloat? There are a number of Irish giants who are well known. One who's lesser known as Patrick Murphy. He really was a giant. Yes. He's buried in County Down in Kilbroney Graveyard outside Rostrever. It's time, Patrick Murphy. Take the chills, the high fever, take the headache, the backache, the bellyache and bulking, and multiply it to the size of that enormous man. That Irish giant adrift in Marseille. Bad enough for anyone. The rash on the forearms, on the face, on the torso, the blisters that break and scab over. But unthinkable, his reach, his vast hands trying not to rip at his skin, his limbs thrashing about in an ordinary bed, a terror to himself in that foreign port, in and out of delirium, as ships hove to and the fog was all Carlingford Lough, and him back in Rostrever, Kilfeighan, sleeping between his parents, James and Peggy. A tall young man when he left for Liverpool to work on the docks, but it was his return too late for his father's funeral. He couldn't have taken a lift of the coffin anyway. He was like a lumbering gantry, a prodigal parody of himself, a good foot taller than when he'd left, and still growing, like forced rhubarb, all pale and lank. Not the first man to get too big for his boots, lose a farm in Tamnavay, say he'd outgrown the place. He couldn't shake that down from the mountains awkwardness. They stared, the people of Kilbroney, halted mid-sentence, while he gabbled on about nothing, unstoppable as the Cassie water. His reticence hardly mattered in the travelling circus. They spoke for him, pointing out his long arms and long feet, him all vertical, bizarrely shy, repeating that all his body parts were just as impressive, all in proportion. He saw more than he ever wanted, over the hedges and ditches, into people's stunted desires. Lonely in Kilbroney, lonely in Marseille, and all the shrinking places in between. It took the smallpox to bring down that huge humanness, the big death of his bewildered body, aged 28. Was the only way he could come home to stay. I'll read one more from Ask Me Next Saturday. That title, by the way, allegedly one of the answers that Joan of Arc gave when she was being tormented. You know, they would say, what did your voices smell like? What tone did they use? And one of the dodges she used was, ask me next Saturday. This is called The Wounded Heron, and it's dedicated, it's a memorial poem for Niall Vallely, who was from Armagh. And amazingly, clever man, who meet you in the corridor and say, sorry, excuse me, was I ever married to you? he and his brother Dyro were so Bacchetti and just like that. The Wounded Heron for Niall Vallely. Another brother is Brian Vallely, or John B. Vallely. He's a very fine artist, but also a fine Ullian piper. A heron's legs are so still standing, so still flowing behind it in flight. returning from Niall's funeral, a dead heron on the roadside, its legs still, still. The wingspan of sorrow wider than us, 6 foot wide, the wingspan of a grey heron. Once, when my car screamed across an ice road, yet I lived, shaken into my skin with the nearness of leaving, skidding back into my own life, I saw a heron, larger than life, larger than my life, standing. When he took flight, startled from his spilling, sloping, perpendicular self, his back all curl and curve, I became a witness to the ease of how to lift into a whole spontaneous grace. It is less like birdsong, more like anti-song, the bony noise, raucous retching from the heron's throat after all that silent watching, that immense light flight across our cloudy eyes. The heron's wings pulse through twilight as an ullion piper kneads the bellows with his elbow, mysterious rhythm feeding the chanter and the drones, controlling the breath. Your brother at your graveside, Niall, as the day darkened, not able to stop playing his pipes, wanting the skirl to go down into the earth with you so it wouldn't be so cold, so heavy, so finite, the finite clay, whatever the flight you'd take away from our clumsy dust, startling you from your rapport with grey, with rock, to be glimpsed against the aching sky, clinging to its hold on light, before you merge with everything we can't quite make out by sight. And straining for the heron cry, its jagged, unsingable angulars of loss, unsure if that was what we heard. My previous book of poetry was about the Holocaust. It's called Grimm, and it is grim. I went to Auschwitz, and I had no intention of going in order to write, but it stuck in me, and I realised that we all think we know, but I hadn't known. So I wrote a sequence that accidentally takes 20 minutes to read. I'm not going to read it. Be glad to hear it's, but in a macabre sense, it's exactly about how long it took to die in a gas chamber. I thought that was an instant thing, but it isn't. Mm. But what then attached itself to that was the bizarre nature of how humans behave through and after horror. Things like a beauty contest for Holocaust survivors. You know, not that long ago. And you think how grotesque, how terrible. And then, well, why not? Surely surviving is exactly that you survive to have the right to be as banal or as incongruous as everybody else. That's what survival is. So I'll read one, and they're all real, those second part of the book. This is based on Hans Lipskis, who was the chef at Auschwitz. I just thought, what an extraordinary thing to be, you know, someone who nourishes and sustains, but in that context. The hand that feeds you. Hans Lipskis, cook in Auschwitz from 1941 to 1943, was charged at the age of 93 with being an accessory to murder. The steam in the kitchen made the cooks purblind as the hogs' heads boiled for 5 hours to make head cheese. Hans let them cool, then scooped out the brain and cheek from all the slippery concaves and convexes of the skull. He placed the meat in dish towels and tied them with string. These he soaked in a brine of brown sugar and onion and allspice and garlic salt and bay leaves and white pepper for 2 days, pressed down with a board and a clean rock. Then it could be sliced cold and served with vinegar and pickle and Graubrot, rye bread. The skulls he would boil again for the prisoners' watery soup, and he would add the potato peelings from the soldiers' thick kartoffel soupe and the woody hearts of the cabbage left over from the brat and sauerkraut casserole. He utilised everything. And anyway, when the peelings were thrown away, some prisoner always retrieved them raw and ate them rotting from the rubbish. When times were tough, he had to be inventive with just tinned flesh or wurst, but at other times, roast mutton. As the knife's serrations scraped out marrow from the bones, oh, a sound like someone clearing his throat. The kitchen had its own phonetics, the diphthongs and gutturals and double consonants of appetite. Strudel, Pflaumenkuchen, Hasenpfeffer. It was an art to demonstrate with surgical precision how to dress, disjoint and divide a rabbit. He had an empathy with food as he leaned down to the ovens to control the temperature, sensing exactly how much longer the chickens needed for their skin to blister crisply over succulent breast meat. He always kept the scraps of such meals from the soldiers' plates for the prisoners' daily soup. Even sucked bones, saliva, would not matter to people who could steal a morsel of bread from a corpse. While he was on duty selecting which vegetables could last another day and slow roasting old broiling fowl, a goose, some shot ducks in foil with onion powder to tenderise the tough bird so that it would be palatable, over 1,000 Jews might arrive by train. It was a fine, large kitchen, 12 chimneys, but it was not easy making food to undernourish so many. He could never be sure how many mouths. A litre of gruel for each prisoner, sometimes so watered down that to get the slightest nutrition, so much had to be drunk that it strained the kidneys. And each prisoner had to get a portion of brat every day. Though when they could, the kitchen staff held back enough sugar and yeast for an illicit fermentation whose frothy kick brewed in them the feeling they were in charge of their own patch. It took the discipline of his visceral self to manage amidst all those bodies the culinary manoeuvres and strategies of food. Otherwise, the waste was unthinkable. So I was going to read a poem about Oscar Wilde. The alternative is one about Jim Morrison, but
Oscar.
Yes.
Men should dress more in velvet. Oscar Wilde, 1854 to 1900. Voices and birdsong filtered through sash windows, settled in the folds of fading drapes. After his sister died, home was never the same. At school, he slept with a lock of her hair. Living above lake mist, he counted out the beat of days, learning off by heart the scansion of survival. From the worn stone echo, he wrote to thank his mother. The pears and the grapes were so cooling, only the blancmange a little sour from the knocking about. Sent down for half a year from Oxford for not knowing his place, he squinted in the blowback from the unused chimney, posted smoky mythologies to friends he had hosted way beyond his means, promising malt whiskey and wild salmon, urging them to join him shooting hare and grouse on his estate in Connemara, where he, a foreigner in his own country, hated to be alone with the damp mattress stillness and the huge rain, the dulling fur, the haunt of hung game. Leaving behind his favourite colour, rose, his saddest word, failure, he wrapped himself in velvet and crossed the Atlantic to lecture on beauty. His picture with lilies and sunflowers sprouted on advertisements for Straton and Storm's new cigars. He disliked the look of Verlaine, who waited with annoyance for his whiskey glass to fill, failed to respect Henry James, who came humourless to call, strode from Walt Whitman, who made him milk punch, to Victor Hugo, who said, "How good to meet you," then fell asleep. Drawn to pipe smoke, the dusty sweat of the gaming room, he gambled all his dollars for the thigh close company, that piercing gaze into his grey-blue eyes, the gentle danger, the thrilling potential of defeat. Back in England, he cut his hair, married the aesthetics of family, the Chippendale chairs, the white carpet choking him, chiding Constance and the boys in velvet sailor suits, while craving an undertow to the purity and plush, the heady ooze of white lilies lingering in the brittle celibate air. The delirium of hotel rooms, purple tulips wilting against a yellowing wall, smoke-stale brocades, glass rings on a polished table where he could write, room to smooth the roughened edges of unbeautiful truth against some young affordable stranger. Abandoning himself to the art of belonging in the dusky stairwell of another man's limbs, spending half an hour a week at work, hailing a hansom cab, his day pouring through sallow wines, the mist of liqueur glasses late in the afternoon, his genius inducing laughter, the curtain rising on his honeycombed and brandied thoughts. Until the tawdry drama of the courtroom scene, the testimony of hock and seltzers, cabs and hotel bedrooms, champagne and cold fowl, wit ebbing from his soliloquy with the crudest interruption concerning boys and kissing boys. As dusk drank the light into its nebulous understatement, no hotel would have him out on bail. It was a nauseating wait for trial, the inevitable, the unthinkable verdict of jail. The beginning of autumn, his favourite season of the year, London dripping with rain, handcuffed and shorn, he winced wordless as each train pulled into Clapham Junction. 30 minutes of spat derision, waiting in convict clothes to be taken to Reading Jail from Wandsworth Prison. The first 3 months without books or mattress, the debtors walking on white carpet to plunder his shelves of Hugo, Whitman, Swinburne, Verlaine, and all the gilded vellum of his dreams. His mother, Lady Wilde, denied her dying wish of having Oscar by her side, came herself to tell him she had died. Cloaked in February chill, she did not speak and would not stay. But what was worse, that fingertips he'd kissed through prison bars left him with heart-stopping night cold that sank into his brain, his own words becoming a bitter accomplice, blaming his love, holding in place the syntax of hurt. No happier on his release, he sobbed alone in the hotel room, left the fine ground coffee cooling, horrified in the gloating air. Far from the pims and lawn tennis of his undergrad scribbles, the page stained with summer strawberries, he wrote of the treatment of fellow prisoners. His name excised from Portora's list of pupils, from billboards, from book spines. In Europe, lost himself in orris root, narcissus, the dusk of red roses. I live on echoes, feed on fevers. Unable in his brilliance to find words to say goodbye to himself, unable for the endless atonement for what he wasn't, who he was. I rely on receiving from you the £150 you owe me. His last letter from the Hotel d'Alsace. Buried 9 years in a pauper's grave, before the cut limestone of Père Lachaise, the scattered roses and carnations, the puce pink lipstick kisses, his poetry palpable, pulsing. What purple hours one can snatch from that grey, slowly moving thing we call time. I got to hear one of Anne Carson, the Canadian, marvellous Canadian writer. She gave some lectures and I got to hear one of them, and she was talking about Xenophon, the ancient map maker, and she was connecting it to her father's dementia, and she said that it occurred to her that in his incessant questioning, her father was doing was trying to create a lunatic Xerox of his own life. My father is in a care home. So I'll just read a short one from the sequence that I wrote. After 4 hours of blood transfusion, my father was raving. Are you okay? Well, I am and I'm not. They had come from the south of France or the south of England. Who? Well, have you seen them? Perhaps some blood donor gifted you these inconvenient, inconsiderate ghosts who came to visit but bypassed you. Or 4 hours of chat with the blood nurse when I've relished an afternoon off. Were you simply crazy with a day of kindness and conversation? Thank you.
We have a huge round of applause again for Kate Newman.